Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present David Gibbs, professor of political science at the University of Arizona, who questions claims that U.S. military intervention in Afghanistan will prevent future acts of terrorism. Gulf War veteran James Madison, who shares his experience in talking with students about his opposition to the war in Afghanistan. And Ali Abu Nima of the Arab American Action Network, who evaluates the prospects for success of a new U.S. effort to negotiate a ceasefire between Israelis and Palestinians. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Financial Times reports that new oil exploration off the coast of Western Sahara is complicating peace efforts in the disputed territory. Within the last year, Morocco has signed over 40 leases with oil drillers. In May, one oil drilling group, led by Australia's Woodside Corporation, hit crude oil off the coast of Morocco's neighbor, Mauritania. At the time, the oil prospectors declared, this could be like finding a new Gulf of Mexico. For the last decade, the Western Sahara has been the focus of a United Nations mediation process. The rebel Polisario Front wants full independence for the disputed region that was till the late 1970s ruled by Spain and later invaded by Moroccan troops. For most of the 1990s, the UN proposed a referendum in the Western Sahara for the native Sahrawi people to decide if they want independence or want to be incorporated into Morocco. The Polisario Front is now challenging the right of Morocco to grant oil exploration leases for land they do not legally administer. The oil contracts are with the French oil giant Total and Oklahoma-based Kerr McGee to drill in a 90,000-square-mile zone off the coast of Western Sahara. At the moment, the UN is investigating Polisario's claims that the oil leases are not legal. A clear decision by the UN could poison already heated talks over the fate of the Western Sahara, slowing the 25-year dream for self-determination for the people in Western Sahara. On September 23rd, in the worst coal mine accident in nearly 20 years, 13 Union coal miners were killed in an explosion in a mine near Brookwood, Alabama. Although the coal mine disaster was ignored by the mainstream media, consumed with America's war on terrorism, mine unions and workplace safety experts saw the deadly accident coming. In the last 3 years, according to the news magazine In These Times, the coal operator Jim Walter Company was cited 250 times by the U.S. Mine Safety and Health Administration for allowing combustible materials such as methane and coal dust to build up underground. With little fanfare, coal miners die every year in underground mines. But these usually small accidents get little press attention. An additional 1,500 miners and retired miners die each year from black lung disease caused by inhaling coal dust. Tighter government regulation could help prevent illnesses from coal dust, but the coal industry resists government monitoring. The Bush administration earlier this year made it more difficult to apply for health benefits related to black lung disease. Now critics say it takes a big accident to wake the public up to the hazards of coal mining. According to J. Davitt McAteer, head of mine safety during the Clinton administration, worker fatalities are seen by the coal industry as an acceptable cost of doing business. If the public at large said it was unacceptable, then things could change. Long before the September 11th terrorist attacks, news executives were cutting back on the number of reporters and editors working for major newspapers and wire services. The massive downsizing campaign got noticed last spring when San Jose Mercury News publisher Jay Harris quit rather than impose the deep cuts mandated by the paper's corporate owners, the Knight Ridder chain. At the New York Times, company president Russell Harris cut 1,200 jobs while reassuring readers that the journalistic quality at the nation's most respected news organization would not suffer. According to Extra, the magazine published by the media watch group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, the news is much more grim at the Akron Beacon Journal, also owned by Knight Ridder. Because of heavy corporate pressure to cut costs, the Ohio Daily newspaper axed its Sunday magazine and Sunday opinion section, closed its Washington bureau, and cut its state house staff to only one person. Although newspaper ad revenue has slumped in the past year, most newspapers made an average 21% profit in 2000, more than double the profit at the average Fortune 500 corporation. The problem is that Wall Street wants bigger and bigger profit margins, and the easiest and quickest way to do that is to lay off reporters. Inside many top newsrooms, veteran reporters are starting to challenge management over the number of recent layoffs. As Philadelphia Inquirer reporter and editor Stephen Seplow lamented, you can't keep losing that talent and put out a quality newspaper. There is a clear sense at corporate headquarters that nobody much cares what goes into the paper. They only care what goes into the bank. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Reaction to the terrorist attacks of September 11th, President Bush declared an American war against terrorism. On October 7th, the U.S. launched a bombing campaign in Afghanistan and is now massing ground troops to set up a land base near Kandahar, the last stronghold of the Taliban. Working with the Northern Alliance, the U.S. search for Osama bin Laden continues, with claims that his capture and the dismantling of the al-Qaeda network would greatly reduce the terrorist threat against the U.S. But some observers believe that if bin Laden were captured, it would be relatively easy to reconstruct his terrorist organization. The main requirement, demonstrated in the last few months, is people willing to die for their cause. To underscore the resolve of some Islamic extremist fighters, loyalists to Osama bin Laden staged an uprising against their captors in the city of Mazar-e-Sharif, Sunday, November 25th, and hundreds of soldiers were killed by the Northern Alliance and U.S. forces who assisted in putting down the rebellion. While political leaders and the media applaud the results of the U.S. military assault on Afghanistan, many Americans are asking if this will make America more secure. David Gibbs is professor of political science at the University of Arizona. Your reporter, Denise Manzari, spoke with Professor Gibbs, who questions claims that U.S. military intervention in Afghanistan will prevent future acts of terrorism.
The United States has scored what, at least to appearances, is a major victory already, of course, with the Northern Alliance capturing the capital city of Kabul. The United States is now sending increasingly large numbers of ground forces, particularly the Marines, into Afghanistan, but it would seem that they'd have a more of a function of, shall we say, a mopping up operation, or at least I think that's the intention. And now the U.S. military may assist the Northern Alliance and its allies in hunting down al-Qaeda groups in Afghanistan, and of course the most important figure being bin Laden, at least in terms of his symbolic value. In the last 15 years, all the major conflicts the United States has had have purportedly been with individuals. Slobodan Milosevic, Saddam Hussein, Manuel Noriega, Muammar Gaddafi, and of course now Osama bin Laden. There seems to be a great need to personalize these things, to simplify complex issues and to turn them into kind of morality plays, where if you can eliminate a single evil individual, you'll solve the problem. The obvious problem with doing that with Osama bin Laden is, A, he has organization, al-Qaeda, which seems to be very decentralized and designed to operate if the headquarters is knocked out. And so killing bin Laden wouldn't by itself solve the problem. And of course, there's a larger problem of resentment against U.S. foreign policy and anti-U.S. attitudes that have fostered the rise of al-Qaeda and no doubt exist outside of al-Qaeda as well. And so even if al-Qaeda were knocked out, which is very unlikely, you would still probably have terrorist groups that are willing to do things like fly planes into buildings. Unfortunately, a major consequence of the U.S. war may very well be to inflame the problem and even act as a giant recruiting poster for future generations of young men, possibly young women, to engage in terrorist acts. I fear that may be the long-term effect of this war.
What about the historical aspect of this and the role that the United States played during the war against Russia's invasion of Afghanistan and actually aiding the Mujahideen and Osama bin Laden?
Well, it's a very good question. It must be said that the current problem is, to a significant degree, blowback from past failed U.S. policies. In particular, the U.S. policy in the 1980s of supporting Islamic extremist groups in Afghanistan against the Soviet invasion. The United States aided a series of groups, the Mujahideen, they were collectively known as, that got very good press in the United States. Most listeners who remember this conflict probably remember the Mujahideen Freedom Fighters, as they were called. What we weren't told is they mostly were pretty horrible groups, led by pretty horrible people, and particularly the main ones that were supported by the United States. And the one the United States backed most heavily, the Mujahideen leader named Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, was an Islamic extremist who adopted policies that weren't really that much different from those of the Taliban. So there was clearly a U.S. role in fostering Islamic extremism in Afghanistan during the 1980s. Secondly, the United States encouraged the influx into Afghanistan of thousands of Islamic fundamentalists from around the Middle East to fight the Soviets. According to the French newspaper Le Monde, Osama bin Laden was recruited by the CIA in 1979 to organize resistance against the Soviets. There's a great deal of circumstantial evidence supporting Le Monde's contention. And bin Laden was very definitely a U.S. ally against the Soviets during the 1980s. And his transformation into an enemy has to reflect badly on the previous U.S. policy of supporting him.
What about the United States being a bit more careful about who we ally ourselves with in terms of who we support in overseas battles, who once were supposedly allies and then become the enemy?
It's quite an irony that American foreign policy during the 1980s was portrayed as being one to further U.S. national security, as all U.S. foreign policy is portrayed as doing. The irony is that its main effect was to increase U.S. insecurity and make the U.S. less secure in ways that were very dramatically demonstrated on September 11th. One can only speculate as to the long-term consequences that this war will have for U.S. insecurity. One point I've already alluded to, that it does risk inflaming Islamic opinion and possibly increasing the number of people who are willing to engage in terrorist acts against the United States in revenge for the U.S. Actions taken in Afghanistan. That is a possibility that has to be considered. Another, of course, is backing specific groups, in this case the Northern Alliance, who may cause more damage down the road. The Northern Alliance itself has a very bad record. Human Rights Watch published a report indicating that the human rights record of the Northern Alliance in the past has been appalling. So the U.S. is once again backing groups with unsavory records, and I fear that's a policy that could come back to haunt us down the road.
That was David Gibbs, professor of political science at the University of Arizona. For more information, visit the website www.gened.arizona.edu/dgibbs. As the U.S. war in Afghanistan entered its second month, President Bush put out the call for veterans to speak in schools in commemoration of Veterans Day. He asked them to discuss their experiences defending freedom and democracy. Many responded, including James Madison of Middletown, Connecticut. Madison served honorably with the Marines during the Gulf War, but since then has joined the group Veterans for Peace. For years, he has spoken out against U.S. foreign policy and military interventions, including the current war in Afghanistan. So Madison, a self-described patriot, formed a group called Veterans Teaching Peace in Schools. He put out his own call through the internet to find other veterans with similar views to talk with students about their opposition to the war. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with James Madison about his opposition to the Afghan war, criticism of U.S. foreign policy, and how students have responded to his views.
One of my concerns was that I know there's a lot of veterans out there who don't necessarily feel that this war or our militaristic foreign policy in general is a good idea. And I knew that there were people like myself, veterans, who wanted to speak on behalf of peaceful alternatives to the war. And so as soon as I heard about Bush's call for veterans to go into schools, I realized that I could throw together an organization that would be kind of a counter-movement. And so I got on a few email lists, talked to a few people, bounced some ideas around, and ended up getting some pretty good response from both veterans who wanted to speak to students, as well as teachers and students and parents who wanted to have veterans come and address their student groups.
How widespread was the response?
We actually ended up getting organized in 28 states altogether. I have a total of about 70-something veterans who volunteered to go in and speak, and about 60 people who wanted to volunteer to be coordinators, you know, like I said, teachers, students, others who wanted to get those veterans in there. And the response was very strong, especially from the veterans. They wrote me a lot of good emails about their concerns and about their experiences, and they had a really intense desire to get out there and share the fact that there's some different points of view that really need to be considered as to how we can approach this particular crisis as well as our foreign policy on an ongoing basis.
Well, you served with honor in the Gulf War. Why are you opposed to the war in Afghanistan?
Right. I joined the Marine Corps when I was 17, and I was in Desert Storm for 8 months or so, about the entire war. And, you know, at that time I was very gung-ho. I was a young person, and I felt that that was the best way to serve my country. But, you know, as the years passed and I got out, I looked at our foreign policy, and I realized that a lot of what we do as a nation is very destructive around the world. I mean, we have been bombing and invading and occupying nation after nation, decade after decade, for almost a half century now. And I realized that that kind of military action throughout the world is exactly the kind of thing that that causes people to hate us. And when you engage in this level of militaristic behavior all throughout the world, you make enemies. And those enemies inevitably come back to do you harm. And I realized that our militaristic foreign policy, far from making us safe, is in fact the very thing that is putting us in danger. It's the very thing that makes people hate us enough to plot to come back and to hijack our planes, to level our buildings, and to do things that are very harmful to us. What I didn't want to have happen was to have people believe that somehow just because a person is a veteran, they're automatically going to subscribe to the war, that they're automatically going to support, say, blind obedience to our government. I don't want that to be the understanding that people have.
What did you find when you spoke in schools? Did you speak more than once, or how many times did you speak to students?
During the 11th to the 17th, I gave two speeches. And I've been talking about this issue for years, but this now I talk about it with specific reference to September 11th and to Afghanistan. The response I get is pretty interesting. You know, once you explain to people our point of view, once you point out that for the last half century we have been engaging in some severe military actions. For example, we blew up the pharmaceutical factory in Sudan, wiped out half of their pharmaceutical supply because we said it was involved in chemical warfare. Turns out it wasn't. We backed the Israelis when they went into Lebanon and killed 10,000 people, mostly civilians. We bombed Iraq flat, and now we've isolated it for 10 years so that they can't rebuild their water treatment plants, they can't rebuild their power generation plants. The country is in ruins, and according to UNICEF, 4,800 children a month are dying over there because of the contaminated water and the lack of medical care that comes from not having electricity. And we bombed Kosovo, we blew up the Chinese embassy, we fly spy planes off the coast of countries like China, and the list goes on and on and on. And those are the kind of things that, you know, people don't really think about, but when we go in there and we explain that, and then we say, you know, we are, in fact, an occupying force in Saudi Arabia, which they consider their holy land, the Arabs consider their holy land. And when you start itemizing all these things, people realize, wow, you know, there's a reason that we're developing all this hostility around the world. And people begin to see the connection. And I'm always careful to point out, you know, this all of our military action doesn't justify what happened on September 11th in any way. But when people see the connection, they start to understand that a lot of this is because of the hate that we create through our own foreign policy. And I don't get a lot of resistance on that once I explain it to people. They start to see that. One of the concerns, I think the biggest concern I get is, you know, how do we end it now? How do we get out of this? We've dug ourselves so deep. We have troops in over 100 countries. We have hostile engagements that we've done for decades and decades. And that's a challenging issue. We really, as a nation, through our military actions, have dug ourselves into quite a hole, and we've created quite a bit of hate out there. But, you know, what we're saying is we need to start somewhere, and we need to start now. And there are some very legitimate alternatives, things that we could have done differently. For example, in the after this war with Afghanistan, negotiation wasn't even tried. The administration immediately dismissed it. The Taliban had a meeting of their clerics, and they decided that they wanted to negotiate and discuss. And that wasn't a delay tactic. That was a legitimate response. That was part of the Arab culture, the desire to negotiate and think things through and work things through. We just dismissed it. We didn't try to build an international coalition. We're basically operating unilaterally. We could have done some type of international coalition. We didn't really build that up either. We also should have gone through criminal justice channels. It's very simple. September 11th was not an act of war. It was a crime. And the reason is very simple. That is, governments commit acts of war. Individuals commit crimes. This was not an event that was sanctioned by a government or initiated by a government. It was a group of individuals, a group of highly motivated, very hate-filled individuals who decided to attack us. But that is a criminal act, and therefore we should have pursued criminal justice channels on an international scale. All of these things we could have done instead of just jumping into war.
That was Gulf War veteran James Madison. For more information about veterans teaching peace in schools, visit the group's website at www.arrels.com/MADJM. A growing number of nations concerned about the continuing violence between Israelis and Palestinians have exerted pressure on the Bush administration to abandon its policy of disengagement from the Middle East conflict. Calls for more direct U.S. participation in peace negotiations have also come from Islamic nations backing the American military operation in Afghanistan. In response, the White House has sent retired Marine Corps General Anthony Zinni and Assistant Secretary of State William Burns to meet with Israeli President Ariel Sharon and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat in an effort to broker a ceasefire. Adding to the urgency of talks was the recent deaths of five young Palestinian boys, aged 6 to 14, who were killed by what an Israeli newspaper says was a remote-controlled Israeli army bomb near their village of Khan Yunis. In retaliation for these deaths and the Israeli assassination of a leader of the militant group Hamas, a Palestinian suicide bomber detonated the explosive he was carrying, injuring two Israeli soldiers at a Gaza Strip border crossing. 14 months of violence in the Middle East has claimed the lives of 722 Palestinians and 189 Israelis, according to a November 26 Reuters report. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Ali Abu Nima, vice president of the Arab American Action Network, who examines the obstacles that stand in the way of achieving a ceasefire and a viable long-term peace agreement.
The conditions under which they would succeed is if the United States is willing to address honestly and openly what the structural situation is here, that you have military occupation, and that is the root and cause of the violence. The occupation is constant, permanent violence against the entire civilian population of the West Bank and Gaza, 3 million people. And under that situation, some Palestinians are bound to react violently. You can't abuse millions of people and not expect some to react with violence. And that's what's happening. What Sharon would like, what the Israelis would like, is to be able to continue to confiscate Palestinian land by force for Jewish-only colonization, to continue to be able to destroy Palestinian crops and trees and citrus and olive groves, to continue to be able to destroy Palestinian houses, to shoot dead anyone they don't like, and for Palestinians not to react in any way at all. Now, the vast majority of Palestinians do, in fact, continue to struggle with daily life without resorting to violence, but some do react with violence, and I think that is inevitable under that situation. So Colin Powell, in his speech, did mention the occupation many, many times. In a break with recent U.S. Pronouncements, he stressed that the occupation has to end. He stressed how humiliating it is for Palestinians, how many innocent people have died. And he said simply it must end. The U.S., while they're able to point to the problems, they're unwilling to address the fact that without U.S. military and economic aid, and to a large extent diplomatic aid, Israel could not sustain either the occupation or the settlements. And this conflict would probably have been resolved a long time ago, but for the fact of unconditional and massive and crucial U.S. support to Israel's occupation. And that the envoys are certainly not going to address.
Do you think that the Bush administration has new resolve to take on the complex issues of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, given that the coalition that has backed the Bush administration military assault in Afghanistan is quite fragile and demanding some real changes in U.S. foreign policy, overtly and certainly behind the scenes?
Well, prior to September 11th, I think the view in the Bush administration is that this conflict, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, is a little local difficulty. It's an ugly ethnic conflict, which we would prefer if it wasn't there, but it actually, can't really do anything to harm us. It's not like in the Cold War when these minor conflicts could, bring the superpowers into confrontation, as indeed the Arab-Israeli conflict did several times. So their view was this was a local conflict like Northern Ireland, which just needed to be managed and certainly didn't need the investment of the time and prestige of the president. Now, after September 11th, when the U.S. set about building a coalition, they realized that, in fact, this conflict is central to the relations of the United States with several dozen Arab and Muslim countries, and it is central to the perceptions which people in the world hold about the U.S. The U.S. talks about freedom and democracy, but it supplies the weapons and support for Israel to suppress freedom and democracy for Palestinians, people say. The United States says it is against, ethnic cleansing in the Balkans, but people say, why is Israel allowed to, build Jewish-only settlements on Palestinian land, demolish houses and so on, with U.S. support? So this inconsistency in U.S. policy is central in the way much of the world understands U.S. Foreign policy. So I think that some people, Colin Powell, understood that. I think President Bush understood that. Tony Blair understood that, which is why all of a sudden they started to talk about the need for a Palestinian state. The problem is we have to understand that policy towards Israel is not primarily a foreign policy issue. It is a domestic policy. And the reason we're not going to see more forceful action from the United States is simply because the administration, I don't think politically, is willing to stand up to do battle with the Israeli lobby domestically in Congress, which is very, very strong, which can, in a second get 95 or 96 senators to sign onto a letter saying almost anything they wanted to do. Without sustained political support within the United States for a more forceful U.S. approach, we're not going to see it. Even if they understand very well at the State Department or the White House what needs to be done, they're not going to do it at the level of political risk it would take today.
That was Ali Abu Nima, Vice President of the Arab American Action Network. Contact the network by calling area code 773-436-6060 or visit their website at www.aaan.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.